How's everybody doing? My name's Will. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Will.
And this just got sprung on me, so it's pretty cool. Not much time to get crazy about it and be all worried. But just to say, I'm honored to introduce the next speaker tonight, a gentleman who I connected with some years back in sobriety. And like Nate was talking about, that untreated piece, that first step was really kicking my ass, excuse my language. And God put this man in my life and saved my life, you know, really saved my life. And I'm here. I drove down here from New York. I don't know if you knew I was from New York or not. But just an honor to be here and an honor to introduce the next speaker, Mickey from Colorado.
My name's Mickey. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
There's this turban, you know, that I sit and I go through all the self-doubt. What do they want to hear what I have to say? And then something happens and the turban starts to roll and gin up, and I came here with a lot to say. And I was given a gift before this meeting to just spend some time sitting and talking with an angel who carried a message to me and reminded me why I am here and why we are here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 weeks of sobriety, straight up. I was 27 years old. I had been hospitalized with a suspected heart attack when I was 26. I was burned down. I'd been drinking since I was 4 years old, and I'd spent my whole life drinking. It's like I got on this train when I was a very little boy, and I grew up in Europe, and in Europe they give children wine cut back with water for the evening meal, and aren't we European, and ain't I alcoholic, and they just lit that flame. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I got on the train. When I got sober, there used to be a chart on the wall in the AA club that I got sober in, and it was like a horseshoe, one of these numbers. And the idea is we're born and we're like pure, I guess. I don't know what they're talking about, but in any event. And then we start to drink and we start to go down the horseshoe, you see what I'm saying? And then we hit bottom, and then we get help, and we go up the other side of the horseshoe, we get to the top, and the sun breaks through and the angels sing, and you know what I mean? Well, I got on that horseshoe when I was 4 years old, and they didn't know that they just lit my relationship with alcohol, and I didn't know it. I thought that if you were a grown-up and if you were a man, you drank. You know? No big deal, right? Everybody drinks. What's the hubbub, bub? And so I got this thing, and so I drank. And I don't know what to say about it except that I disappeared. I could get onto the floor, but I couldn't get up. I could get into the bar, but I couldn't get out. I could take every relationship I was in, and I could crush that son of a gun. And I was dying inside. And I went in at 26 years old into this hospital. And I'm very finicky. I'm not going to be the guy who's going to be the, what do they call it, the guys that travel in the ambulances and go out and help people.
EMT.
I could not be an EMT. You're bleeding, I'm sorry. I'll see you. See you later. And I got put in, I guess they call it a semi-private room. And what we had was, is if you were doing a play, it would be this drama. And there would be the young alcoholic. And he's in this room with the old alcoholic who has got wet brain. And I'm finicky. And this guy needed to go to the bathroom, and I would hold the jug so he could pee, and he peed black. Everything was shutting down. And I'm in that room, and I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no footwork. I got nothing. But I'm in the room with this man, and I love him. There's an alcoholic going in, and there's an alcoholic going out. And he was restrained. I remember, you know, they can take the hospital beds and they lift the arm, the rails up. He was restrained by gauze because he was so far gone. And they're testing me to find out if I'm dying. And then I came into AA when I was 27, and that was 42 years ago. And this God is so powerful that I got 42 years when I was asking for 2 weeks. I thought if I could just get 2 weeks where I wasn't hurting like that, where I wasn't that sick, I'd wake up and my hands would be all screwed up, and I didn't know what. I said to this friend of mine, I said, man, what's wrong with my hands? He said, it's the booze, dummy. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. It's like I came in from Mars or something. I didn't know. You know what an alcoholic is. Let's get this on the table right now. An alcoholic is somebody, it doesn't have to be a height issue, but here it is, about this tall, with an overcoat on. It's the middle of summer, and he's got it stuffed with newspapers so he doesn't freeze to death sleeping on the park bench at night. That's an alcoholic. Skid Row, that's an alcoholic. Not when you're 27 years old and you got a London fog raincoat, which is what I showed up in AA in. I'm very, very emotional about this. How do you tell somebody the story about how you got your life given to you? Okay, so I'm running around. I leaned on priests. I went to places. I got married. I was married 3 years, still drinking. We had a daughter who I terrified. It took over a year in Alcoholics Anonymous for my 4-year-old daughter to stay in the same room with me. And I knew there was this great success because I told her to do something and she looked up at me and she said no. And she wasn't afraid, you know what I mean, to express a little bit to her old man. And anyway, what happens is that I met my wife. I was a singer, and I was doing my first professional gig with my singing partner in this bar, and she was a hostess across the hall. And so what happened was they told us, you know, if I tell you to sing at night, the owner says, at 9 o'clock, you start singing at 9. It doesn't matter if anybody's in here. You sing from 9 to 1:30 or whatever it was. And that's, so it's 9 o'clock. We got nobody in the joint except this woman, and she's sitting there, and she's our audience, you know? And she introduced herself, and I thought, she said, my name is Murray. And I thought, yeah, this is pretty interesting, a woman named Murray. It's Marie, but anyway, I heard Murray, and she was drunk, and I was sober. And that's the last time that ever happened. And I looked at her and I said inside of myself, I said, I will never let her go. I fell in love with her right now, which is not unusual for an alcoholic to do. But it is unusual to have a 45-year marriage out of it. And so we went down, and so pretty soon, you know, I'm making like $70 a month as a singer. We're living in a room over this old woman downstairs. Marie's got a muffin in the oven. You know, we are screwed. And so finally, we were paying, I think, $70 a month for that room. And the mattress was like suede, you know what I mean? And I'm, you know, at that point I was 6'3". I weighed 145 pounds. I want you to know I was really put together. But anyway, and so I was killing my back, you know, so we just took the mattress off and we put it on the floor so I could try to get some sleep. And the old lady downstairs was vacuuming the stairs, and this is a dated comment, a question, but you'll get it. And she's like, she sees the mattress on the floor and she says, "Are you a hippie?" And I was a losty. I don't know what I was. And she raised the rent $5 a month and we moved. We moved six times in the first year of our marriage. Anyway, at one point, this is my only claim to fame, I'll lay it out here. We had some backers, and one of our backers was the son of Joe Louis, the Brown Bomber, the famous Joe Louis, the boxer. And so at one point, we were living in his basement. He was a greeter at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. So anyway, we were living over there in the basement, and I'm coming unwrapped, just crazy, as a March hare. And I went over to a satellite office of Denver General Hospital. A satellite office means, you know, it's just somewhere out in a neighborhood. And I went over there, and I'm talking to this woman, and I'm bobbing and weaving. You know, man, I was fast. I was fast sitting down. I couldn't sit still. And, you know, we're talking, how you doing? I'm not doing very well. And we're talking like this. And, you know, she says, "You seem nervous." I was pretty nervous. And she started giving me Librium and Valium, which calmed me down, you know. So I'm trying to fix hangovers with alcohol and Valium. And after a few weeks, I thought I'd ask her this question. I said, "How am I doing?" And she says, "Do you really want to know? If they ask that, say no." I said, "Yes, I really want to know." She said, "Mickey, you're the most negative human being I have ever met in my life. I don't see how it's possible for you to be walking around out there. And if you've ever experienced a 50-minute hour, baby, here it comes. Whoops, time's up. I'll see you next week." Next week? I'm dying. What's next week? And over time, I finally came around to calling Alcoholics Anonymous. I called Alcoholics Anonymous, the 1311 York Street Club, if anybody's been to Denver. And we called it, you know, the mother house. Anyway, it's a three-story Victorian mansion close to downtown Denver, and you can go in there all hours of the day and night. So I called him at 10 o'clock one night, because Marie and I had sat down and talked about where were we going to institutionalize me. I did not know I was alcoholic. Where are we going to institutionalize me? Because I'm obviously nuts. And the way she found out I was nuts is, well, living with me. But we had this discussion, and I was halfway up the stairs from the living room, and she started talking, and we were talking about things, and I started rocking, and I tore the banister off the stairs. And she said, "You know, there's really, really something wrong here." She said we'd be driving in a car, and she would be, you know, over here riding shotgun, talking to me, and we were having great. And she'd look out the window to look at something in the scenery, and when she'd turn back, she was sitting in the car with somebody else. And you know the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, right? That's about alcoholism. You know, Dr. Jekyll would drink the stuff and he would turn into Mr. Hyde. And Mr. Hyde was crazy as a March hare. And it didn't take that to do it. I could just be Mickey and do one of those numbers. I was in serious, serious trouble. 10 o'clock one night, I called York Street and I said, "Do you have any meeting?" I didn't know anything about AA. "Do you have any meetings or anything I can come to?" And the guy said, "What's your problem?" And I said, "I'm an alcoholic." First time I ever said it. And he said, the strangest thing, he said, "Congratulations." And I'm going, like, I just told this guy I'm a moral leper. And he says, "Congratulations." And I'm going, this is a weird trip. And he said, "Why don't you come down and we can talk?" And I said, "I can't. I got my daughter here. My wife's not here. I can't leave." And he said, "Would you like somebody to come over?" And I said, "Yes." And then I got really nervous. I went around and started cleaning the house. I forgot to tell you that I was 1 week sober. I had gotten this opportunity. I'd gone a week. I woke up in the morning one morning and I said, this thought hit me. I can't stop drinking. I had never had that thought. It just didn't hit me. But now this thing hit me and it's like, I can't stop drinking. And it was like a revelation, man. I'm 27. I've been drinking for 23 years. And I thought, wow. And I didn't have a drink for a week. We were invited to some people's house. I went over and I told Marie, I'm going to have one. That's my last drink. I had one glass of beer. I don't know. And then I went another week and I said, man, if I don't get help, I'm never going to stay sober. It's never going to happen. I'm going to go right back on that train. And I'm going to go not go on that train because I'm thirsty. I'm going to go on that train because that's where I've spent my whole life. I'm just going to get on the damn train. And like Nate was going, we'll just die there. Hell with it. And I called them and they came over, these two guys. So I'm straightening up the house and Marie comes back and I said, Marie, I've called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're going to come over. And she said, well, should I stay? I said, I don't know, because they don't give you a blueprint for your own 12-step. I had no idea what we were going to do. And so these guys rang the bell, and I was really nervous, like, what were the neighbors going to think? Like they wore A's on their shirts. And I got nervous, and they came to the door, and I said, I introduced myself and I said, this is my wife and she's not alcoholic. Can she stay? And the guy looked at her at the 12 step and he said, can you be honest? And she said, yes. And I vouched for her. And he looked at her and he said, first thing I want you to know is you're just as sick as he is. And our 12 step went from there. And these guys were talking and they said, you know, like this guy was telling me that he was locked up in a jail in Tennessee, coming out of a blackout, accused of the murder of his wife, and he didn't know if he'd done it. He had blood all over his shirt. He didn't know. Turns out she had left. He's accused of murder. And I'm listening to this story. I didn't do that. But there was something in that guy's heart that was touching something in my heart. And my prayer, and the longer he talked about this as a disease. And you can recover from the disease of alcoholism. And inside of myself, I've been getting this medicine from these docs. I've been going to these head shrinkers, and God bless them. I'm sure they can be very, very effective in helping us with certain things in our lives. But I'm inside, I'm praying, please, God, give me alcoholism. Please give me alcoholism. Because I can get well. Maybe from alcoholism, and I'll never get well from the stuff that I'm drowning in over here. And I went to my first meeting the next day in my London fog raincoat. And I was in advertising, and I was all, man, I was decked out. I was ready for it. And I'm going to meet my boss at the airport. And my boss was a telephone junkie. And we're sitting across the table, and I said, Bill, and I mean, you know, I'm about to get fired from my, I got fired from my last job. I'm about to get fired from my first national advertising agency. And I've got a daughter and a wife to support, and it's not going well. And so I said, Bill, I found out what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to my first AA meeting today. And Bill looks at me, and he doesn't say a word, and he gets up and he leaves the table. And I thought, oh, man. Here I am on my first, you know, venture into a new life, and I've already lost my job. And he came back, and he sat down at the table, and he looked at me, and he reached into his coat pocket without saying a word, and he pulled out the 24-hour-a-day book. And he was a sober alcoholic. I didn't have any fancy footwork, you understand. I had nothing. I had my London fog raincoat, which had more spine than I did. And the first thing that God gave me was another alcoholic sitting across that table from me, my boss, saying, it's going to be all right, brother. We'll get there. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? So when we talk about the power of God in here, we don't talk about the power of God as an academic exercise. We're not trying to prove how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. We're in here because we got no place to run and no place to hide. This is it. There's either a God or we're screwed. Right? Yeah. You can call it by any name you want. The power, you can do this. I don't care. But it nets into, is there a resource, a higher being that I can go to get help? Because guess what? And again, I'm not trying to like take the whole psychology and psychiatry thing out of the picture, but if you're going to talk to my head, we've got a duel going on. Right? I had a guy who used to say he was rubber-minded. I can take any thought in my head and massage it around to my own ill. If you talk to my head, we'll go dueling heads. But if you talk to my heart, you are now talking to where it hurts. So let's get down to basics. Where does it hurt? What are we doing here? Are we here to try to figure out an answer like we've been trying to figure it out all our lives? Is that what this weekend's about? We're going to get some fancy footwork. We're going to get it all nailed down. And that's how we're going to walk out of here empowered. What we're going to talk about this weekend is total collapse. And in the face of total collapse, is there any hope for this carbon unit? Is there any way for me to walk out of this place this weekend and survive? And better than survive, can I live? And better than live, can I make a contribution? Is it possible that God made me to accomplish things in this world and make a contribution? Is it possible I may have skills and talents that I'm not aware of that can wake up because of me just rubbing up against God? I'll tell you, I've rubbed up against some pretty nasty people in my life. And I took on what they had. Have you ever had that experience, anyone? Took on what they had. I took on what they had. I can't say this the way I've always quoted it in my life, but I'll say it this way. He may be a jerk, but he's the only friend I've got. Right? And I'm going like this. I'm no prize, you understand. I'm no prize. It's not like he's bad news and I'm not. I am. I was kicked out of every school I went to when I was growing up. And I remember one of them, my second grade report card. I found a box of report cards. And in it, it said I had A's and B's in the second grade. So I didn't know why. I'm telling you this story because there's nothing wrong with my intellect. There's nothing wrong with my mind. There is something wrong with my soul. If we don't do any other business, that's why I came to Georgia, is to talk about where it hurts. There's something wrong with my soul. How do we know this? Out of the big book. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I've seen people try to go to the gym and outrun alcoholism. Can't do it. Do you know what I'm saying? And I've seen people with PhDs could take themselves down a toilet faster than you can say hello. But if you talk to my heart, you're going to be talking to where I am hurt. So I got this opportunity and I started on this journey. But here's what happened. Human beings, we are competitive animals. Would you agree?
Yes.
We will compete about everything. So it's like, I'm better than you and here's why. And it's like, we won't say that. But we carry it like a disease. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I was so screwed around, I did not know what kind of a drinker I was, but I got to find out quickly in here. Son, I spilled more on my tie than you ever drank. Okay, I'm 27, and you're like probably my age now. Oh boy, now watch this. I have just flunked Alcoholics Anonymous because in the great, right, I flunked everything else. I mean, this is serious. It says, you know, frothy appeal will not appeal to an alcoholic, but I am begging you to listen. Because this counts. This counts. So I flunked everything. I flunked church. I flunked school. Man, I'm telling you, I was no genius about it. I remember sitting for 10 days in a tree when I was in grade school. I didn't have any place to go. I just couldn't sit in that classroom. I couldn't do it. And I was just running, and I don't know what the hell. So there's these things that I've found in my life, and they're very, very valuable gifts. And there's a book I've never read, the title of which I've carried with me ever since I heard it. And the title of the book is What Makes Sammy Run? What Makes Sammy Run? And I've been running all my life, you understand? And I don't know what's chasing me. Is this making any sense? And what's chasing me, see? I don't know what's chasing me. Now, you can talk about drinking all week long. Now, I'm in AA and I'm sober. I'm dry as the Sahara Desert. And I want to die so bad I can taste it. Now, what's further complicating the picture is I got a loaded 32 automatic pistol in my top drawer. Every alcoholic who comes into this program has a plan. It'd be real interesting if we could ask everybody, what's your plan? Well, that was my, here's my plan. If this doesn't work, I'm putting my brains on the wall. It's not a great plan. But I promise you that was the plan, and I had that gun in my drawer for the first 3 years of my sobriety because I couldn't stand it. I used to go to AA meetings, and I would come back from the meetings, and I would lay down in the dark in my living room. My wife's in bed down the hall. I would lay down on my face in my living room, and I would beg God to kill me. Because being sober was not fun. I was like, I was a fish out of water. I'd been drinking all my life. Now I got no way to put the fire out. You understand? I am just like here. And inside of me, I'm wondering, when do I get to go home? You understand? When do I get to go home? I'm sober now. When do I get to go home? The answer is, Mickey, you don't get to go home, not to that home. You get to come home here. And it was so upside down. There's a blues lyric that said, I've been down so long, it looks like up. Well, what does up look like then? It looks like down. Whoop-de-doo, I'm sober. And I've heard people talk about a pink cloud. I did not get a pink cloud. I guess you can get that. What I got was this walk, and they didn't offer me anything else. And when I found out that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is based on God or a spiritual deal, I thought, God, are they going to try to fix me with fairy tales? I am in trouble. So I came up with this, and I was hanging out with a bunch of guys that were really, really rough. And my sponsor was in that crowd. And I said to my sponsor, I'd like to have lunch with you because I've got something I want to tell you. And he goes, oh, okay. So I got there and the whole group was there, including the lead dude, Big Frank. And they're all there. And I said, guys, listen, I didn't know we were all going to be meeting here. But I got something to say. I made a discovery. I'm not alcoholic. Because I got to get out. I mean, I'm not telling them I got to get out of here because I ain't going to do fairy tales to pretend like I'm going to, you know what I mean? So I said, that was my announcement. And I'm with guys that are like blooded veterans, okay, and they're all looking at me. And Frank looks at me and he said, I tell you what, he says, there's a bar on the other side of this restaurant. Come on over, I'll buy you a drink. And I said, no, man, I can't do that. He said, why? I said, if I take a drink, I'll go to hell. And he says, and you're not alcoholic? And that was the end of that whole discussion. It's another great plan. So I started on this journey, and I've never been offered anything in Alcoholics Anonymous except the big book. You know what I'm saying? And it was not like, but they had this other plan. There was sort of an alternate plan, and I'm not putting this down. I'm just telling you I couldn't do it. There was this whole volleyball plan. There was this whole potluck plan. Man, I'm telling you, then somebody tricked me into going to a conference, whatever that was, in Amarillo, Texas, and it was like you know, and everybody's volleyballing, man, and I'm in a leather jacket smoking cigarettes up against the wall, and I ain't going to have any volleyball. And we are not going to hug. I don't know what the hell that is. I don't mind hugging the women, but all this men, new. So I was not doing well. And I celebrated my first AA birthday at a nut house in a Fort Logan mental health deal. And I wasn't in it, but I went to talk there. So I'm giving my talk. And there was this woman. She was amazing. She taught me this thing. She would arrive at 1311 York Street on the back of a Harley driven by an ex-heroin addict. She was 17 years sober. She'd come in like these stiletto, you know, leather, everything. And she was in a meeting, and I'm sitting there, and we're all in a discussion meeting, and she said, and I knew that she was 17 years sober, and she scared me. I mean, I thought she could beat me up, honestly, if you want to know the truth. And she said, you know, I think I'm going to take another trip through the steps. I'm going to go back and work the steps again. And she worked the steps, and she turned from this ice-cold human being into this lovely, open, warm person. And I watched that transformation, and I registered it, because I'm alcoholic and I'm not stupid. They don't equate. I've got a terminal illness, baby, but turns out I am observant. Anyway, so her name was Jerry, and Jerry was at my first AA meeting talk, you know, my birthday. And so, my first birthday. And so after I talked, she came up and she threw her arms around me, and she stopped dead, like she just hit the brakes, and she peeled her arms off me, and she said, I will never do that to you again without warning you. That's how frozen I was. And I had a guy tell me, he said, Mickey, if the 88 keys of a piano represent the full range of human emotion, you have two. Excitement and rage. Oh, we got those two. Now we just got to work on the other 86. What I'm trying to describe to you is that without alcohol, I was lost in the tall grass. I just didn't know. It was like people were talking down one of those old-fashioned ear horns that they, you know, when they didn't have hearing aids, they'd have these ear horns so people could hear. And it was like I was also looking at life through the wrong way, through the binoculars. It was just bizarre. And I'd sit in discussion meetings, and they'd say, Mickey, what do you think? First of all, I'd freeze out of fright. Secondly, I'd have to poll the committee inside of me as to which Mickey was going to stand up and answer that question. Because when I was drinking, if you asked me, Mickey, what do you think, I would get that look when I'd answer. I don't know if you ever got that look. They're looking at you like, are you a Martian? What the hell just came out of your mouth? And I mean, I'm just sharing. Let's share. I'm not the worst alcoholic who ever came in here. I drank enough to get here. I thought I was too young to be an alcoholic coming in at 27. And then I went to a meeting, and there was a 14-year-old girl in there, and she had had all the drinking she wanted in her life. And I revised my opinion of what an alcoholic is. And I started down this road. Now, what happened down this road is that I had to bring Mickey with me. And I hated him. He had flunked everything. He was weak. The way I handle, like, let's take sports. Let's go play football. The way I handled playing football was I got drunk, and in my mind, I was the quarterback of the football team. And when I was growing up, all the dances had names. And the way you learn the dances is you go over to a girl's house, and you do those dances in her basement. You put on the music, and you would do the Watusi or whatever it was. And what I did is I got drunk, and in my mind, I was the world's greatest dancer. I just wasted my life in alcohol, in delusion. So now I got to take Mickey everywhere. What I wanted to do was drive downtown, have him get out for ice cream, and drive away before he came back. Really. Really. So now I got to go and do a search and rescue mission on Mickey. Forget what I'm going to do with somebody else. We can always teach somebody else. Do as I do as I say, but don't do as I do. You know what I mean? It's like that. I can't even quote it. And the hardest job I've ever had is to stand up and be me. It's really hard when you take all the nonsense and all the fantasy out of it. It's really hard to be who you are and think that matters. And on top of it, I was trying to play a role. I come from an all-military family. Oh my God, my dad's was a West Point graduate. My brother was a Marine officer. My other brother was a Navy pilot, both served in Vietnam. And here we go, you know, and I had lousy knees and I couldn't even get into the service. Thank you, God. Nothing against service. I grew up in the service. I tell people I got out of the Air Force when I was 14. But I couldn't measure up is what I'm trying to tell you. Kermit the Frog says it ain't easy being green. If you had to lay out exactly who you are in this room, would you be comfortable doing it? Most people would not, because we have all this stuff and we put on this deal. So I read this in another book. We wrap ourselves with the bandages of ego like a mummy. And then we identify with the bandages and say, that's me. And we're afraid if those bandages are unpeeled, there will be no us. Right? Does that make sense to you? Like, we'll be the hole in the donut. But the big news is, if we will start, with God's help, working this program to start unwrapping those bandages, we're going to find out who we truly are. And who we are in God is the only thing that matters. I may be able, as Nate was saying earlier, I may be able to impress you, but it'll be with my tap shoes on. My job is to impress God with trying to be exactly who He made me to be. And it is a big surprise. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write the great American novel. And what I instead did is I spent 25 years in advertising writing ads. I thought I was going to die, but I had a wife. I had 3 kids to educate. I had responsibilities, and I did 25 years of it. And I ran to the end of that deal. The whole culture had shifted now. And it's younger. It's a younger person's game, and I didn't know the vocabulary. And so I couldn't get a job in advertising anymore. And I went and started temping. And I'm doing temporary work now. I'd had my own ad agency. And so I couldn't get a job in advertising, so I started going out and temping. I'm doing 10-key data entry. And I thought, my God, can I even be an employee? Can I even be an employee? And I learned from you that we are worker among workers, and we do a day's labor for a day's wage. So I sat in there and I did my 10-key, and man, I can't type. I was in there like boom, bada boom, bada bango, and we're entering credit card transactions to these 2 or 3 hospitals, and it's a mountain of work. And there's a young man in this little cubicle with me. It's a separate room, actually, and we're sitting back to back. And, you know, and we're working away, and I'm going like onesie, twosie, and he's over there. He is rocking. This guy's got it going on. And I'm in there. I got my brown bag lunch. I think I'm making like $7.50 an hour, which I would not spit on when I was making real money. 6 figures, thank you very much. And I'm hoping I can hold on to this job because my wife and I have to eat. And so this is real training in Alcoholics Anonymous, in our lives. This is real training. This is a real school, man. If you think you're going to get sober and stay sober without suffering, you're in the wrong outfit. So I'm in there doing this, and the woman, our boss, our supervisor, opens the door one day, and she says, "Man, I've got to let one of you go, man, and I'm reaching for my brown bag." And she let the other guy go. Oh, I got to tell you, before he went, we're working away one day, and I'm listening to him rock through these keys, and this voice comes over my shoulder. He says, "You like Whitesnake?" I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Right? And I go, "Sure." And I'm hit with this wall of heavy metal coming out of his box. Do I like Whitesnake? Anyway, they let him go and they kept me. And that happened at every job, every place I got a temporary job. They would offer me a job. They'd offer me a job. They'd say, "You're doing great." And I couldn't do it. I mean, I was just really plugging away through this. And God was supporting me, just like my boss was supporting me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know this. I know it's late, and I'm going to make this fast. Nate was referring to the fact that alcoholism exists separate from the bottle of alcohol. He didn't say it that way, but I'm telling you, right? What we want to say is, "I did these crazy things because I drank. I'll write off everything to drinking, but okay, now what? You ain't drinking. How's it going?" Right? And we're not going to tell each other how's it going because we're competitive. We're not going to tell the person next to us, "I am so lonely, I feel like I'm dying. I'm 25 years sober and I can't get a job. I'm scared. I don't know how to live." Now we're getting down to where it hurts. Do you see what I'm saying? I have this thing that happens inside of me where I started out on this great adventure, and then I have to tell him what color the parakeet in the cage was, and I forgot what I'm saying. It's gone. I'm sure it was really cool. I'm sure it was really rocking, you know what I mean? But it's out of here. Okay, I know what it is. So if we can grasp the concept that alcoholism is a real disease, and what I try to do to deal with it is I try to drink alcohol to manage my alcoholism. Does that make sense to anybody? And then the drinking of the alcohol becomes a worse factor in the disease. And that alcohol can kill me. But guess what? My disease can kill me in this program. Stark raving sober. Make any sense? Mm-hmm. All right. So from like 18 to say 23 years sober, I did not have a sponsor. I would confer with my fellow wizards, you know, and we would share about the higher aspects of alcoholism. But I didn't have one. And then I met her. And, you know, there's a lot of hers and hims in our fellowship. There's like mostly just hers and hims. And I did not have a sexual relationship with her, but I went into fantasy land. I'm failing in my career. I can't make a living. I'm going down the tubes. And she thought I was wonderful. You know what I mean? She had stars in her eyes. And I could have used a couple of stars, to be honest with you. And then I mainlined her, and I didn't even know there was this hidden agenda in my life that I want somebody to worship me. I don't know if you can relate to this or not. And she did it. And I fell into the, you know what I mean? What is that line? I fell into the burning ring of fire. Well, I fell into the burning ring of fire. I tend to make everything funny, but this is not a funny story. So what happens is I'm cheating on my wife in the worst way, in the worst way, in the heart way. I'm out of my mind. And that went on for like 4 months, and then she boogied. And at one point, I told God out loud, I choose her over you. Mm. Out loud, I said it. So I would have put any amount of money in the world on the fact that I would now, in sobriety, never take my life. At 23 years sober, what happens to a person who is a suicide? A suicide eliminates options, right? And the world goes like this. And it narrows and narrows and narrows until there's only one option, you see? And that's to take your life. So one night, I just couldn't go on anymore. I couldn't. I had office space, an advertising agency that didn't have any clients. I had a telephone that never rang. I had to face the fact that I was down the tubes. I had lost everything. My wife's fighting off the creditors. And I got onto the floor and I couldn't get up. And I think we had like AstroTurf carpet. And I'm on the floor and I could see it above my head and the sun's setting. And I went to hell. Now, if we define, just for the sake of us talking tonight, that hell is the absence of God. Hell is the absence of good. I went to hell for 4 hours and I had a knife at my wrist. And it was like, I'm gonna kill myself. Well, if I'm gonna kill myself, I better try to crawl out that back door because I'm gonna make a mess. And I don't wanna have to have somebody clean it up. So if I can get out there, but it was getting cold out there, and I know that once I cut my wrist, I'd go into shock and it would get really, really cold. And so I was going through all this in my head, every 5 minutes, I'm gonna do it now, no, I'll wait 5 minutes, and I'll do it later. I'm 23 years sober and disconnected, obviously, from the power. So finally, I couldn't do it anymore. I just realized I can't do this. And my wife didn't know where I was or what was going on. And I fell asleep. And when I woke up, I was devastated, of course, but I remembered that I met a woman in St. Paul, Minnesota, and in Minneapolis, and she knew this man in St. Paul that she really thought was aces in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, I'm going to call her and try to get his name, and I'm going to call for help. And I got her on the phone. And one of the prayers that I had right at the end of what would have been my life was, I had two prayers. One of them, a statement to God, and I said, God, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. It was just closing in so hard. And the other one was, God, will you please give me a cookie? I just wanted something that was sweet. Just something that was sweet that could break through this blackness. So I called this woman and I asked for his number and we got to talking and I told her where I was and I told her what the circumstances were and what I had just almost done. And she got her AA literature into her lap and she started 12-stepping me. And she was like, you know, two things, please don't be offended, but you know, I come from, you know, an older generation, you know, A, she's a woman and B, she's less sober than me. Please. I love women, but I'm just telling you what was going through my mind, all right? And this woman is on the phone pitching me, and she's fighting for my life. And I listened to her, and she was making sense to me. I mean real sense. And I asked her to be my sponsor. She said, oh, no, 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 no. Of course, now that's violating all the rules or whatever. You know, to have a woman sponsor is less sober than me. Please, where's my competitive pecking order here? So, she agreed. She said, I'll sponsor you long distance until you find a male sponsor and we'll go on like that, okay? And her name was Cookie. Straight up. Her name was Cookie, and I'd been asking God, please give me a cookie, for weeks. Even in my madness, he was there. Even as I was about to commit the worst act a human being can commit, he was there. I love you. I love being with you. I love walking this road with you. I am so honored that you invited us to come and be with you. Make no mistake about it. This weekend is going to be absolutely down to where it hurts, because there's somebody in this room who's going to take themselves out, or there's somebody in this room who cannot lift their chin, lift their head up and have any modicum of faith, who doesn't want to hear this, who thinks it's bullshit. And that's who I came to talk to and to be with you. I just love you.